You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Hello, happy new year. You are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Brian O'Reilly for the past couple of hours. But now at 12 p.m, it's time for Bums on Seats, the fortnightly swing and miss of everything that has been newly released at the cinema. My name is Toby Miller, and my fellow pugilists on the show this afternoon are Emma Marchant.
Hello.
Steph Smith.
Hello.
Mark Livesich.
Good afternoon.
And new reviewer, Dave Moyby.
Hello.
Our first proper show of 2015 has an interesting relationship with the truth, with five new films that drift from hard fact to supposition and innuendo. The Theory of Everything mixes physics and romance with the true story of Jane Wilde's long marriage to Professor Stephen Hawking. Exodus, Gods and Kings is director Ridley Scott's biennial trip to the old-fashioned epic, this time reimagining the Hebrew flight from Egypt. 20 years since Ed Wood, Tim Burton risks himself once again in the Californian sun with Big Eyes. Unbroken offers unimaginable hardship for the new year, with Jack O'Connell acting up a storm as the Olympic athlete who becomes a Japanese prisoner of war. And Michael Keaton's history as Batman seems to inform the trials and tribulations of his has-been actor in the virtuosic drama Birdman. So that's all to come, but we start the ball rolling with the Big Bang.
Come on, get up.
Morning, Brian.
Stephen, are you aware that you've voluntarily embarked upon a PhD in physics? Hello.
Hello.
Science.
Arts.
I'm a cosmologist.
What's that?
I study the marriage of space and time.
The perfect couple.
What if I reverse time to see what happened at the beginning of time itself?
Wind back the clock.
Wind back the clock?
Keep going.
I don't know how.
Yet.
Keep winding!
Where's you?
It's called motor neuron disease. Life expectancy is 2 years.
I want us to be together for as long as we've got.
It'll affect everything.
But I love him. And he loves me. Going to fight this illness together.
There's very nearly a cottage industry in film biography springing up around Professor Stephen Hawking. Only 16 or so months ago, the Cambridge Film Festival opened with a comprehensive documentary, and now a new release, The Theory of Everything, tells his story once again, only this time from the perspective of his first wife, Jane Wilde. Directed by James Marsh, who has dabbled excellently in both documentary with Man on a Wire and drama with Shadow Dancer, The Theory of Everything is adapted from Jane Wilde's autobiography. Eddie Redmayne stars as Hawking, a brilliant, though rather lazy, student. He meets Jane at a college ball. A chemical reaction occurs between a physicist and a poetry student. They fall in love, but Hawking's limbs are beginning to fail him, and doctors sadly announce the first signs of motor neuron disease, incurable and terminal. Stephen and Jane marry, only too aware of the problems that lie ahead, but determined to do what they can to beat the disease. Steph, to start with you, The Theory of Everything seeks to strip away what everybody knows, the famous public persona of Professor Stephen Hawking, and find the love story at its core. Does this approach work, do you think?
I'm not sure what people know about Stephen Hawking. He seems this
Everyone recognises the voice that he's adopted. Everyone recognises the image in the wheelchair. But actually, beyond that, I'm not sure what the public perception is. So telling a story, I think they had a blank canvas to start with. All they had to do is at some point represent him as everybody everybody's familiar with him. So I think, in short, yes. I think it was told, I think, quite an elegant, very human love story, while at the background also kind of touching a little bit on science, which I really liked.
Mark, we've just had... This time of year is the cinema's always thick with biopics of difficult types who learn to love or whatever. But they never seem to rise. They very rarely rise above TV fodder or feeling like they're TV. James Marsh is a very capable director. His last film, Shadow Dancer, is rather excellent. How's he managed with this story?
I think for me, it's telling that James Marsh has a background in both documentaries and in that last narrative form, which was Shadow Dancer, which I also loved. For me, this feels like a narrative documentary. It doesn't sort of follow your normal type of three-act progression where you're seeing an event and then the event has a consequence. It's more just the detailing of Jane's life and her interactions with Stephen, pretty much in sequential order. Consequently, it's a fairly undemanding watch. I found it a very pleasurable watch. You know, I think there was a lot of interest going on in the story, but it doesn't take any risks of any kind in terms of the way it approaches that. It's absolutely a performance from Eddie Redmayne that's calculated for the awards season. I'm not suggesting that's why they made the film, but you can see why it's released in January as a consequence, because his performance is the kind that awards people absolutely go for. I think the one that which we then risk getting overlooked is Felicity Jones, who's just amazing as Jane and gets to do all the more subtle emotional work in terms of the performance, and she's the one that for me carries the film.
Dave, to come with you on that, this is based on Jane Hawkins' autobiography, so they drew the story from that source. And Stephen Hawking as a character sort of vanishes, obviously, as his motor neuron disease progresses, his character sort of retreats into the background and she becomes the foreground character. Is she drawn strong enough for that to work? Does the film hold its interest with just her at the core, do you think?
I think so, definitely. When I was watching the film, I had very low expectations, and just seeing Felicity Jones perform was amazing. She was very subtle and she didn't try to overact. And I've seen her in, I think she was in Dagenham Girls, and she just carries it very beautifully. So I think, yeah, she does carry the film in a way which you wouldn't expect, but it's quite mesmerising.
Do they do enough? Because the film starts, hints at, rather than trowels it on too thickly, that obviously she is religious. She's Church of England at the beginning of the film, and she's religious throughout the film, whilst Hawking remains atheist. It sort of deals with that, but do you think they allow that to paint her character too much? She sort of, as good as Felicity Jones is, her character, Jane, sort of retreats into this mousy, sort of church mouse type character. I felt that was a little bit regressive, but do they enough with the religious angle to make that worthwhile?
I don't think they were trying to go for the religious angle or the science angle. Really, I think they were trying to concentrate on the marriage and just... it's a very gentle look at what is a troubling marriage for what eventually turns into. And I think that was what was carrying it, not the fact that she was religious or the fact of the science. I think that's more for the audience to feel some relation of these two dual things going against each other. But really, it's just the love, which is what the whole film is about, which is a reason why so many people would go and see it. It's the theory of everything, and it's Stephen Hawking, and it's this great love story. And I think that's the idea that she's religious is pushed to the side, and I think that was done intentionally.
Steph, Dave mentioned there that obviously it's a fairly gentle film. Is it too gentle? It's the gentlest divorce in movie history. I'm not saying that they should have put soap opera dramatics in it, and perhaps this is the way it is, and I'm sure this is the way she told it in the story, but it seems devoid of any drama that could possibly trouble the audience. Everybody comes out of this fairly, to the extent that even just about the last shot of the film is them back together again looking at their children with this rather pat line of look what we've created, which ties everything together rather too neatly. Is it too polished? Is it too shorn of the rough edges of life?
I don't think so. I think what kept that journey smooth was Jane Wilde as a character, or Jane Hawking. It as portrayed by Felicity Jones. She wasn't a passionate lover. She was very much in terms of a nurturing lover, which kind of defined their relationship. So when he felt it was time to move on and found somebody else, I think it was her first reaction was, well, not to give up, not to retreat, but to actually to nurture him and say, OK, you need something else. We've had a good life together. Move on. And so that lack of conflict there didn't feel like a retreat from anything difficult in the film. It felt like it was more defining a character that she portrayed. I thought it was quite a brave move to have it as quiet and as I guess devoid of arguing and conflict as it was.
But does that mean that again, to come to you, Mark? Does that mean that it's stretching for drama in other ways? Is it rather an I mean, I like the film overall, but there's rather an embarrassingly cross-cut sequence later on where he has gone to, Stephen Hawking has gone to a Wagner concert, and whilst Jane stays behind at the campsite that they're all in, and she starts to have an affair with Jonathan, who is their carer, who is from the church, and it's cross-cut to make us feel that this happened. That this affair started at the same time as he fell ill with pneumonia, which is how he lost his voice. And it sort of, that started the strange credibility. It became too filmic. It became rather embarrassing, especially as it seemed to be making a point between coincidence and religious punishment, how both those characters would view it. Did you find that it started to fall into embarrassing tropes when it couldn't find the drama in the relationship?
I wouldn't say it was embarrassing. I would say that's the point where the film feels most like a standard film rather than, I think, what James Marsh has tried to craft other than that, which is something a little different. And again, without the drama. But I think actually that works because it's more of a character study and you're actually then picking out the details from the characters. This is a woman who made sacrifices, who invested herself in a relationship despite the fact she was clearly feeling attraction to someone else. And yet when the other person in the relationship then starts to have doubts, you know, he doesn't make sacrifices. He basically puts his own needs first, and it was a lot of that interesting character detail that I took a lot from in the film. You know, it is an undemanding film when all said and done, and you know, it's, I think, one where you're looking for the subtle shades rather than looking for big statements. I think the other thing which it does well in that context is the science, because it explains the physics clearly, but it's never condescending. And I think it does a lot of that in terms of the relationships as well. It puts the detail out there, but makes you draw your own conclusions. So if you're going expecting theatrics, possibly that scene in the opera stands out, because that's the closest the film gets to that, and that's why that maybe felt a little forced, because the rest of the film didn't strive for that and was more effective because of it.
Dave, do you find... I'm fascinated by physics, so I want a film that I'd be quite happy with, a film that just explored the physics. This film does make a careful battle, because the documentary that came out 16 months ago, which you may or may not have seen, focuses almost completely ignores his science, other than something to be trumpeted but not explained, in fear that it alienates the 9 p.m. on Film 4 audience. But this does make an effort to include the science, to make sure that he's outside the relationship. He's a vital, you see, Professor Hawking's a vital human being for this. Do you think it made a fair stab, like Mark, do you think it made a fair stab at explaining the physics but not alienating the audience, explaining why he's so important?
I think so, but I still don't think that was the main concentration of the film, and I don't think the science or the physics was what the director was going for. I think it was mainly concentrating on the love story. So then even, I think recently they did an even briefer version of time. And I think that's basically when people go to see the film and what people want to go to see the film, they're not looking for the science. And I think it is second rate to the film, even though I would have loved to have more science in the film and seen Stephen Hawking in his truest element. I don't think that was what the film was going for.
All right, well, we have to wrap up, but we can't not talk about Eddie Redmayne's performance. Felicity Jones is as good in a difficult role, but Eddie Redmayne, this is almost, I said before we went on air, almost supernaturally good. To come to you, Dave, to finish with, it was...
Yeah, his natural composure is amazing. You see they, at the beginning, when he's still moving and before the disease comes in, they concentrate on his body. And just when he gets into... You just realise how tense your body must be throughout. And I think he must have been... It just seems so natural when you're watching him, it's... I loved seeing him perform, but Felicity Jones really did it for me. And I know you disagree, but...
Yeah, and I think the whole film had a great ensemble cast. I think every supporting actor was absolutely great. But I actually put Felicity Jones, despite the fact it focused on her for a lot of the time as a supporting member of cast, against Eddie Redmayne's performance, which was just... The physicality you generally describe as movement or dance or fight, his performance was incredibly physical, but very, very still. Just his posture, the way he held himself, he was completely believable. And I'd like to just mention the prosthetics as well were completely seamless. And he did not look like Eddie Redmayne. He looked like Stephen Hawking. And I thought it was a phenomenal portrayal.
I didn't even think about prosthetics. I just thought he was acting. I just presumed. I suppose it worked. It does a good job. Mark, just a last point. I'm dragging this out so we have little time for Birdman. is that it did a good job of getting across his mischievousness, I thought, that he feels like a real character. And you can see sort of the Professor Stephen Hawking we see now, you could see that in this younger character. It suddenly it crystallised him a little bit more, I found.
Yes, I mean he's got a particular sense of humour, and that does come across very clearly in the film. And I think that probably gives it some interesting notes that otherwise would have made it a very flat film. I think without those little specks of humour, it could have been a very one-note film indeed. So it's almost a shame for that period when he actually does get pneumonia and loses his voice, because that's when the film is probably at its quietest, when his voice is silenced.
Okay. All right, well, we'll wrap it up on that. The Theory of Everything opened on Thursday, on New Year's Day, and is screening at the Arts Picture House. It is a Certificate 12A. It is said that if you wait in a cinema queue long enough, then you'll see every film style come back into fashion. Pirates, westerns, and musical, no genre stays dead for long. To prove this point, new release Exodus, Gods and Kings is the biblical epic, popular during the late 1950s, and cinema was battling television and now trying to sneak back in the cinemas under the guise of the battle-filled adventure. Directed by Ridley Scott and written by a brace of Hollywood's finest, Exodus tells the tale of Moses and the flight of the Hebrews from Egypt to the Promised Land. Christian Bale plays Moses, the adopted son of the pharaoh Seti. Unlike his brother, Ramesses II, played by a bejeweled and bald Joel Egerton, Moses feels uncomfortable at the abysmal treatment of the kingdom's Hebrew slaves. This murmuring disquiet grows louder when it is revealed to him by Ben Kingsley's tribal leader that he is of Jewish birth, smuggled into the royal family as a baby and destined to lead his people to freedom.
After 400 years of slavery, things here have become much worse. As your brother, you must set them free.
Is that a threat?
Yes!
Let's just see who's more effective at killing.
You.
Or me.
I came to tell you, something is coming that is far beyond you and I. This is about Egypt's survival, do you understand?
Who has been telling you this?
God.
Emma, as is typical with a Ridley Scott film, certainly since Gladiator, Exodus wants to be both thought-provoking, it's carefully researched, you can tell, the costumes are all deadly accurate, and crowd-pleasing. It opens with a colossal battle. Does it manage this typical Ridley Scott balancing act? Does he manage it?
I would not say it's particularly thought-provoking. I personally found it quite crowd-pleasing. Now, I believe I read somewhere it's a £200 million budget, and as you just say, it was written by a brace of Hollywood's finest, they must have either done it for free, or because there is no money put towards this script whatsoever. It's mostly Christian Bale mumbling into like a huge hipster beard with kind of fervid eyes, but then no one does intense fervour quite like Christian Bale. So actually, as kind of, you know, religious fanatic Moses, which he is for most of the film, it works really well. But they have thrown every penny of that into some... it's almost, to me, it's what CGI is made for. The recreation of Egypt, the crowd-pleasing bit in the middle with the plagues. Just, I don't know.
the crowd-pleasing plagues.
You want it to be crowd-pleasing. I was like, wow, I've never thought about just how horrible it would have been to have lived through those plagues. That is gross. I'm sorry, that sounds very... Maybe that sounds a little flippant. But it isn't, you know, it's a rousing tale. Obviously, you know that you know the goodies are going to win at the end. So that's a good thing. The, you know, the supporting cast ranges from the sublime. I think we were talking about Ben Mendelsohn, maybe down to the ridiculous. And when I say Sigourney Weaver, I do not mean her. She's only given two lines. It seems crazy to hire Sigourney Weaver as Ramesses' mother and then have literally say two lines in the whole thing. To then Aaron Paul crouching behind bushes as Joshua the whole time in some of the oddest casting and acting I've ever seen. But it's a 2.5 hour, lushly appointed, fantastic looking retelling of a very famous story. And I did enjoy it. I did not necessarily expect to. We will come to Birdman later. And you know, it's like my two films this week have been completely reversed in what I expected to enjoy and didn't as much as I thought. And what I have really enjoyed, where's just going along for the ride. It's Ridley Scott. I don't know what else to say.
Mark, like all tales of this sort, every telling changes it, and we have history doesn't know which pharaoh might be the pharaoh of the Bible that Moses frees the slaves from. It's just assumed it's Ramesses II, and the way it's assumed it's a number of other pharaohs. None of the dates quite match up. So there isn't a proper retelling. There isn't a real retelling, and a lot of these things just come from the DreamWorks animation. They've only been in place in the tale since then. So, viewed in that light, is this new battle-hardened Moses who has a sword and not a staff, is this a good way to tell this tale, or is it just Hollywood flippancy?
It does feel like a missed opportunity for Christian Bale to sort of wander in the scenes and go, "I'm Moses," in his Batman voice. But I think it could have done with maybe a little more of that lightness of tone in certain points. For me, it steps away from the sort of standard biblical telling of the story, because in the Book of Exodus, in the Bible, Moses is a very active participant. In the film, for the majority of the plagues, he's very much passive. He's in the background. The plagues just sort of seem to happen. You know, he's not having the regular dialogue. And it's only when it comes to the last of the 10 plagues that it then starts to realign with the biblical story of Moses actually going to see Pharaoh and having the direct discussions and warnings and saying, "You better watch out, mate, because, you know, you don't know what's coming." And so consequently, by sort of taking Moses sort of back from the story, and then it's trying to have its cake and eat it a little bit in terms of suggesting that maybe there's ambiguity around some of the plagues, but then when it comes to the last one, the ambiguity goes out the window and it's very clearly an act of God. And it just makes some strange choices. I'm sure people will debate at length the strange choice of having a small child play God.
A petulant child.
I kind of like that. And actually, I don't know the story of Exodus that well beforehand, but actually he makes it very clear the petulant child does just stand there and say, "Right, now you're not doing anything, you just sit back and watch." And that's when the plague starts. So in terms of Ridley Scott's retelling, he makes it very clear that the plagues are God's work from the beginning. Isn't that I think so, yeah. There's a scene where he says, "You're not doing enough, so I'm going to take over now. You just need to watch for a while." And then the plagues start.
I think you know, other versions of the story would have Moses being the mouthpiece sooner, and consequently the story feels less like it's actually focused in character than it's just focused in the events. So consequently, when the events turn up, when the plagues turn up, it's a huge amount of fun. You know, we talked to the about that you get to comedy hangings.
Is this typical Ridley Scott? This is the man who thought Robin Hood should be serious, and that he tries to put everything into a realistic context. Noticeably, this film starts with BCE, before Common Era, rather than before Christ. He tries to make the plagues realistic. He tries to make the possibility that God is only in Moses's mind.
Mm-hmm. You have to say before Common Era, because this is something that's in the religious text of three of the world's major religions, and you can't just single Christianity out of that. So, in terms of... I forgot the point I was going to make now, because you've completely distracted me. You say it's a Ridley Scott in terms of seriousness. My counterpoint to that would be Gladiator, which was huge amounts of fun. You look at Joaquin Phoenix's character, you look at Oliver Reed's character. There was a different tone there, and the set pieces in Gladiator...
That's almost accidental.
That's down to Joaquin Phoenix's excellent performance. In fact, he does try, because this story does not start off at the beginning. You know, you're kind of thrown straight into Ramesses and Moses are already grown up, and Seti is already almost dying or whatever. Very, very similar to the beginning of Gladiator, really. And they do set that up with Seti sort of saying to Ramesses, well, you're not my son, but you're a much better leader than my own decadent son. But I was just going to say that Joel Edgerton doesn't have... Joaquin Phoenix's performance in Gladiator, that worked. Joel Edgerton's performance, Bawdy, is pretty camp at the beginning. It gets better as the film goes on, I think. You do end up believing in Ramesses a bit, but you never really believe in their relationship because you're just thrown straight into it. So you never get this sense that they are brothers who love each other.
No.
It just... That bit doesn't work at all.
And is it too concerned with, again, as we've just discussed with Theory of Everything, of adopting these traditional storytelling tropes? So it's not enough that he's the leader of the Hebrew right from Egypt. He's got to be the proclaimed one. He's got to have this weird father relationship with Ramesses and Seti. These are all traditional story points that have just been shoehorned into an already complete story in order to make it the blockbuster shape.
And the film, to be honest, doesn't make enough of them. I would have actually felt that you could have done more, both dramatically and character-wise, with some of the stuff at the beginning. It's such a shame that we lose John Turturro so early on, because he's one of the best things in the film.
Yeah.
The first hour or so feels like missed opportunities until actually plagues kick into gear and it's like Ridley Scott's actually enjoying himself.
And the CGI comes into its own. But I was going to say, of course, if you'd been busy making Moses the voice of God earlier on, you would have missed out probably on Moses having the time to, in fact, train his resistance army just around the corner from all the Egyptians who were trying
Grief.
To kill him, which made no sense to me whatsoever, but I did enjoy
that shooting arrows from horseback.
Yes,
generations before that was possible.
We had some deleted scenes from Robin Hood we just thought we could use again.
It felt a little bit like that.
Every film he has army training scenes. It's just what Ridley Scott likes. Can we finish off with this question, which bothered me when it started to come up on Twitter, of race in the film, because obviously he's cast two very white actors as two Middle Eastern characters. Everybody else in the film is either Miss Middle Eastern, or that's all sort of Hollywood Middle Eastern, like John Turturro, you know, that sort of, if you're not Tom Cruise, you can pass as any race. Is that a problem? I think Ridley Scott raised an issue in a clumsy way, that if it had Middle Eastern leads, this wouldn't play in the Middle East, for instance. It wouldn't play in China.
It's been banned in Egypt as it is. So,
yeah. But racism is not Ridley Scott's problem. It's actually international sales.
Well, his argument was that it wouldn't have actually been able to make a $200 million picture if you didn't have tentpole names. Well, that's nonsense, because you can look at any number of blockbusters over the past 20 years that have had an absence of big names, and they've just traded on the spectacle, and they've done absolutely fine. I just feel that Ridley Scott needs the safety net of big names a little bit. You know, he doesn't tend to make small pictures, and he doesn't tend to have small casts, and that's why you've got Sigourney Weaver turning up for two lines, you've got Tara Fitzgerald in one scene, because he you know, his sense of epicness is not just about these fantastic wide panoramas, it's also about having a cast that you can look at almost every person and go, ooh!
But that does add to the crowd-pleasing aspect of it. So, you know, you asked at the very beginning, is it thought-provoking or crowd-pleasing? Thought-provoking, not so sure, but it is, I did feel... There was one review I read that says half triumph, half turkey. And I've got to say, I think as a new year, you know, as a kind of new year release or whatever, there is a lot to enjoy on a, you know, for a Friday night popcorn movie. And some of that is just the star spotting.
It's not going to answer any questions you may have about your religion, though.
Okay. No. Exodus opened last week and is screening at both Cambridge Multiplex Cinemas. It is a Certificate 12A and is in both 2D and 3D. I saw the 3D, which looked like made it look like a Victorian diorama.
I saw 2D. It was good in 2D.
Yeah,
no need for 3D.
No, not at all.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You're indeed listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city with me, Tubby Miller, and reviewers Emma Marchant, Dave Moyby, save Steph Smith and Mark Livesich. Our third true story of our show is almost too cinematic to be real, considering as it does of the highs and lows familiar from numerous successful Hollywood blockbusters. Directed by Angelina Jolie, Unbroken is the tale of Louis Zamperini, a man who defied incredible odds simply to survive. Adapted from a 2010 biography by Laura Hillenbrand, an adaptation which has been polished in this case by the Coen brothers, Unbroken stars British actor Jack O'Connell as Zamperini, a bombardier in a wartime B-24. When his aircraft is downed over the Pacific, the film moves in the flashbacks to his childhood. The son of Italian immigrants, a combination of mischievousness and bullying show a gift for running, a talent that would eventually lead him to compete in the 1936 Berlin Olympics. But this sporting success is something that comes to haunt him when he becomes a prisoner in a Japanese POW camp.
However dark the night, however dim our hopes.
Inbound 4 o'clock low.
The light.
We're gonna die out here.
We're not dying!
I hear good news and bad news.
Who is the Olympic athlete? Don't look at me.
Hello, mother, father.
This is your Louis talking. I am now interned in a Tokyo prisoner of war camp.
I can't say this. What it says about America, it's not true.
This man must be taught respect. Each prisoner will teach him this lesson.
Mark, Unbroken can't help be made of elements that are familiar from other films. But does Angelina Jolie manage to lift the story out of those necessary clichés and make it compelling?
I think the exact opposite. I think she manages to bog it down in those clichés and make it as leaden as possible. You know, it was definitely disappointing. The only real positive for me is Jack O'Connell's performance. I think he's fantastic. He's been great last year in 71 in Start Up. He's, you know, I've loved things he's been in for years, right back as far as Eden Lake and Tablock and things like that. Yeah, I think without him, this would be a complete disaster. He gets to actually emote and react in the last half an hour of the film, and that's when actually you start to invest a little bit of interest. But for a film that's got a script by the Coen brothers and cinematography by Roger Deakins, it's so anonymous, it's untrue. There is just nothing in the film to generate any interest. It's a remarkable story, which makes it feel so unremarkable that, in a sense, is an achievement in itself. But all you're left with is this repetitious pattern of the peril he's going through, and you just get left numb to it by the end of it. And I don't think that was what they were originally aiming for.
Day, is Zamperini strong enough in the film? I don't mean in real life, but as the film presents him as a main character. We know nothing. We know he's good at running, but that's it. Other than that, we just get platitudes given to him by his family, by his brother, and then he's in war. We know nothing about it. We know nothing that drives him. Does he hold the film together? Is he strong enough in the way that he's been presented?
I think so. I would say it's Angelina Jolie which causes the problem here. In terms of the directing, she definitely just wanted to concentrate on him being in war. So then you just get flashbacks of his life rather than you actually seeing him grow up. And if you actually saw him train and the whole treacherous thing, which is actually just training for the Olympics, that's hard enough, and you actually stay with this story about the human spirit rather than just the breaking of the human spirit, which is what she wants to get to. Then I also think the actor who played the bird is amazing. He does a very good job. And so
this is the Japanese prisoner. Yes. This is the command, the extremely sadistic.
Yeah, he's quite, I find him quite mesmerizing in the role, but really it's Angelina Jolie. Just, she's not a director. She should stop. In my personal opinion.
But I don't know how much of... I think, Steph, to come to you, I think she's trying to do something that might possibly be interesting here but doesn't work. The stress on the suffering that this character goes through is similar to Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ. And she has, on the evidence of her two films so far, seems to have a similar interest in redemption through punishment or brutality. Does this film... This is a very brutal film. Does it offer enough shade to get away with that, or has it just become a sort of posh torture porn?
I'm still forming opinions on this film. It left me surprisingly emotionally unengaged with all of it, with the violence, with any redemption if there was any, with the story of Louis Zamperini. And he started running because his brother said it would be a good idea and it would get him out of trouble. At no point do you see the passion that's required for somebody to put in the hours to train to get to that standard. And even if you're, you know, a natural runner, you're going to be devoting your life to this, and that just didn't come through. And without that strength shown early in the film, it's very difficult for you to see the strength that he shows later on as being anything other than, I guess, coincidence or kind of dull, just bullish defence.
Is there... Dave, this was originally going to be produced by Walden Media. They backed out in the end. Walden Media does the Narnia films, and its slate, it does lots and lots of things, one of these multimedia companies. But its slate is mainly films with a religious undertone, like the Narnia films or Bridge to Terabithia or things like that. And I think a clue to the film's identity is in their earlier involvement. And this feels like a New Testament tale. And that not much is made of his religion. He gives his life to God on the raft, but it has a simplicity of something that Exodus is actually missing. Do you think that simplicity is the problem? That it's just dwelling on the inner fight that he has to go through without any complication? I'm sure the lack of complication, the lack of incident is deliberate.
Yeah, I would say so. Also, I read that at the end of the actual autobiography, Louis himself had a lot of trouble with coming back.
Oh, he had severe post-traumatic stress.
And he wanted to torture his... And I think if they just added a bit more dimension, it was just very plain the whole way. And until he gets to the war camps, and then you just see O'Connell become like a punching bag. So then probably that's the reason why the simplicity is like basic in its formal way.
But is the complexity, Steph, does the complexity that is there... I didn't like this film at all, but I had real trouble with Bird, with the Japanese, with the commander of the British, of the POW camp, because he was just simply movie evil. And he wasn't just movie evil, he was fey evil. He was slightly feminine evil. They'd hired a Japanese rock star, a famous Japanese rock star, to play this role. He doesn't look anything like the original, the Watanabe that we see at the end. He's far more feminine in this film. And I thought he was just a rather offensive sort of unrealised homoerotic, this femininity against these American machismo. I thought all of that was just there because Angelina Jolie was drawing on Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, and didn't understand
it. Possibly. I saw him as kind of just a placeholder for a brutal psychopath.
But that's not enough. You can't get away with that in this day and age. You need more explanation. You need shade.
That's
otherwise, you are just... It's just a diatribe.
I was kind of fine with that bit of the film because I thought if the story is about the survival and the strength, where the adversity and the brutality comes from doesn't really matter.
I agree.
And I would have been fine if actually I believed and engaged with the rest of the film for that to be completely empty, just for him to be this two-dimensional placeholder character. Didn't bother me.
But what were you learning?
Because lacking the rest of the film, it was a problem.
Outside, he didn't have any other... I don't know, his hardships weren't that divorced from the hardships of everybody else in the POW camp, who were also being beaten. They may not have been picked on to that extent by the commander, but they were living other hardships. I don't feel like his story needed to be pulled out, especially if you're going to ignore all the post-traumatic stress which he got over through finding God.
Well, certainly that felt unremarkable, but I think that was more to do with the way the film told the story rather than the story itself. And the whole post-traumatic stress, the whole what happened afterwards, that could have actually been an interesting film in its own right, but it was just glossed over as text at the end of the film. This is what happened to the character, and
we don't even do that, actually. We don't really mention the post-traumatic stress. They just say that he got over it with forgiveness, which is...
I don't want that. That to me was just pap. It was just a pat ending that he got over this. And you say they didn't mention the post-traumatic stress. They don't even... And then they say he became religious and gave his life to God. I'm sorry, and maybe this is my atheism coming through here. Well, no, it is, Toby. Your atheism coming through here. If you're following a character who believes he gets through all of this through a divine help, then you're not following a very interesting character, because there's no drama inherent in that. It's like a superhero.
I'll give the Christian counterpoint to that. To me, it didn't feel like it explored that faith in any way. It's
only in face value, but it's the whole reason for him being.
Well, what should be the progression of events is he's on the raft and he experiences he almost does this sort of standard film bet with trade off with God that, you know, you get me out of this and I'll believe in you. Then it puts him through the punishment in the camp and doesn't trade on that in any way. His faith isn't tested or examined. or looked at in any way. And, you know, you would think that the man who is nearly broken would at least in some way have examined his own belief after what he was going through. And the film just doesn't have any interest in that at all. The most criminal thing in this is that after the film, I didn't feel I knew Louis Zampineri at all. I went home and read his Wikipedia page. Reading the Wikipedia page is more interesting than watching the film. This is a man... you see the running scenes.
Roger Deakins typed it, so it looks wonderful.
Well, I mean, you see the running scenes. Apparently, if his Wikipedia page is believed, and if it's not, frankly, it's still more interesting than the film. After he'd done the fastest lap at the Olympics, Hitler requested to meet him because he was meeting all the top athletes. And Louis Zampineri stole Hitler's flag. You know, that's a more interesting anecdote than anything that went in the film, and it would have added a variation of tone that's just criminally lacking. The whole thing is
But it's not part of what Angelina Jolie or indeed the Coen brothers to spread the blame are after. They're just after this simple tale of hardship
and
survival.
And it feels like they were almost afraid of that because they didn't feel they could, or Angelina Jolie didn't feel she could balance the change in tones between those two elements. But again, you get the whole running sequence in flashback for no reason. There is no reason why he would be thinking about that when he's on the plane. Just the whole structure of it is making me angry sat here. I mean, I need to stop talking about it now.
Okay, all right. Well, Unbroken is making everybody angry. Okay, all right. Unbroken opened last Friday and is still screening at the Cambridge Cineworld. It is a certificate 15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Straight after we wrap up at 1 p.m. in around about 20 minutes is Bookmark, which today talks to international best-selling author Sophie Hannah, queen of the psychological thriller and mystery. They also chat to Cambridge crime writer Kate Rhodes about her latest novel, The Winter Foundlings. That's all to come, but as I say, we've got just under 20 minutes left of the show left. We sign off with a review of Michael Keaton and Birdman, but before that, we're making some art.
You're gonna love this stuff.
Why are their eyes so big?
The eyes are the windows of the soul.
That's why I paint them so big. I've always done it that way.
Why are you lying?
Sadly, people don't buy lady art.
The painting says keen.
I'm keen, you're keen.
Smile.
We're sold out.
They adore you, big eyes.
He sells paintings, and he sells pictures of the paintings, and he sells postcards of pictures of the paintings.
Good God, it's a movement.
So, are you flipping for all this?
Honestly, I can't believe I live here.
I remember when Mama painted that.
You're confused. I painted that.
Do you want to give back the money? If you tell anyone, this empire collapses.
Is that a surprise?
It's like a mirage. From a distance, you look like a painter. But up close, there's just not much there.
So, who is the artist?
It's been rather dispiriting to see Tim Burton, once the moody teenager of Hollywood, soften and mellow into something as cosy and consumable as a Disney princess. But Big Eyes, the director's first film since Dark Shadows, offers some hope, finding the director back in the bright Californian sun that did him so much good with Edward Scissorhands and Ed Wood, still his two best films. Big Eyes is a true story of painters Margaret and Walter Keane, a marriage whose perfect public face hide a dangerously teetering tower of lies. Amy Adams plays Margaret, an amateur painter who's found a strange style in canvases of children with huge hungry eyes. An aspiring artist himself, Walter spots a success story with his wife's unique work and begins to sell them, but under his own name. As the big-eyed art becomes increasingly successful, Margaret becomes a slave to Walter's subterfuge, secretly producing paintings that she can never admit are her creation. Mark, with Big Eyes, Tim Burton, does he benefit from the simpler story? Does he benefit from stripping away the gothic and the special effects and the toy tie-ins? Does he benefit from just being able to go back to his Ed Wood days?
No, because there's nothing left. It's so far sub-Ed Wood. I love Ed Wood. I love Tim Burton in general. I'm a huge Tim Burton fan. His last film, Dark Shadows, was a crushing disappointment. It's one of his worst films, one of the worst films I've seen in recent years. It was just soulless and undemanding. But actually, it at least was trying to do more than this does. It's not even a story. It's a sort of dinner party anecdote that's got about 10 minutes worth of plot, and it's dragged out dreadfully to however long it is, too long. There's just no sense of interest at all. You've got two performances, one from Amy Adams and one from Christoph Waltz, who are trying to invest something in their characters, but the progression of events just doesn't have anything to it to engage viewer interest. And consequently, with all the Tim Burton-style trapping stripped away, there's one scene where Amy Adams is starting to feel the pressure and is starting to imagine people with the big eyes of her paintings, which is the only point when you feel there was any effort put in, and even that just...
Well, it makes no sense. It's a nice scene and looks good in the trailers and tricks people into thinking they're seeing a film with some visual style to it, but it makes no sense. She's not even at the point of the story where that would even begins to be possible.
No, you never feel it reaches a point where that would begin. There's never reaches that point. And it feels as if the story was constructed from the end backwards, the end being the court case, which in theory should have been this grand spectacle where eventually they end up being both challenged to do a painting, which is not a particular spoiler because it's a matter of public record. But at the same time, it feels like it's building to that, which is tragic in the sense that nothing in the run-up to it is of any interest, but when it gets to that point, it's just dismissed so offhandedly that you wonder what the point of it was in the first place.
Is he not interested in any of the themes here? He's got fantastic... there doesn't need to be much story. There's fantastic ideas to work with. He can deal with feminism in early 1960s California. He could deal with he's got this fantastic sort of Tupperware environment to work in, which he did so well in Edward Scissorhands. He can deal in what makes art art, but he just seems to skip over all of that. He doesn't really seem genuinely engaged, or indeed to have more damning to have an opinion on any of it.
No, again, there appears to be no critical appraisal of anything. It appears to be just the fact that both he and the two original writers who were going to direct it, I believe, originally, like Margaret Keane's artwork. I think Tim Burton had a...
Is that part of the problem? He owns some of her work. He's had her... He commissioned work from her.
Yes. Her
work is not very good. It's startling, but it's not very good, and it's not art. For reasons the film doesn't really look into. No, it isn't. But the film doesn't discuss why it isn't. It seems to be happy.
It sort of tries to present the argument, because you've got Terrence Stamp coming in doing serious Terrence Stamp grumpiness as the art critic. But again, there's no discussion, there's no critical appraisal. He goes, it's not art. The rest of the characters go, yes, it is actually. You know, but I mean, the morality, the ethics of the fact that he markets this to the extent of ending up in supermarkets on print rather than her doing the paintings, that, you know, he's sort of subjugated her to this great extent. None of it it's all surface detail. It's all skimmed over horribly. It's got the depth of the shallow end of a paddling pool. It's just a criminal waste.
Is he not interested in She has a personal vision. Her work is startling. I'm not dismissing it as painting. If I don't believe it's art, the film had to challenge me on that. The film's not interested in challenging me on that, or defending that position, which Tim Burton believes. But he doesn't seem at all interested in what drove her. He keeps saying that Walter can't do these pictures because he has no personal vision. He's not affected by anything. Nothing drives him. He can only sell. He's an entrepreneur. But he never looks into what drove Margaret. No. It keeps her a mystery.
It does, and it at times almost feels more interested with that entrepreneurial spirit.
Oh, it's much more interested in Walter than it is in Margaret. I don't know whether that's delivered or just a poverty of vision on Burton's part.
Well, it's an unfortunate statement for a film that, you know, as you say, should be trying to get feminist messages across and ultimately her ultimate empowerment. I despair, really, at what seems to have happened to Tim Burton over the past few years. You know, to think the heights he achieved earlier in his career and you know, the depths he's sinking to now is...
I come from my position, where he's never really been that good. And then, except for Ed Wood and Edward Scissorhands, I don't think he's made anything worthwhile. It's all been just sort of a flat version of Edward Gorey or something else. I've never seen the appeal of Burton. He seems like a...
As someone who you know, had a childhood touchstone in Beetlejuice and could happily visit that too, you know, at any time, you know, the wit, the invention, the vitality, particularly of that film, is just so desperately absent here. You know, even if there'd been some sense of life to it, you know, the scenes where Christoph Waltz is sort of selling the paintings and so on, you know, there's no pizzazz, there's no real sense of the salesmanship. You see what he's doing, but you don't sort of genuinely feel how he's achieving that success. And again, so much more could have been done with so many scenes in this film. You know, in the hands of someone like a Steven Soderbergh, I could possibly imagine an almost Ocean's 11 style period snappiness.
I think there's a possibility, hedging my bets there, that he's sort of deliberately shooting it like Peyton Place, that there's a deliberate blandness here which matches the period. but it doesn't benefit the story.
No, and we got the same blandness in Dark Shadows, and it just unfortunately appears to be where he's reaching his career.
Okay. Well, Big Eyes opened last Friday and is still screening at the Arts Picture House. It is a Certificate 12A. There's something fitting in welcoming in 2015, a cinema year that will offer up even more superheroes than usual, with Birdman, a film that, whilst fiction, plays heavily off Hollywood's current fascination with the comic strip. Michael Keaton plays Regan Thompson, an actor annoyed he's still only known as the Birdman, the hero in a series of mindless blockbusters from two dozen summers ago. He's determined to use his latest role, adapting and directing Raymond Carver for the Broadway stage, to gain respect and relaunch his moribund career. But over the course of rehearsals, shot in an increasingly playful single take, Thompson's life and what's left of his career unravels.
Are you afraid people will say you're doing this play to battle the impression that you're a washed-up comic strip character?
Absolutely not. That's why 20 years ago I said no to Birdman 4.
Boil the man's off! You do Birdman 4!
You're Birdman. Yeah! You are a god.
Why don't you get your wings in your bird suit, man? Oh,
I'm gonna choke you out!
Let's go back one more time and show them what we're capable of.
Birdman!
I got a chance to do something right. I gotta take it.
Emma, you're on the show partly because you were really looking forward to Birdman. Michael Keaton, it just promised so much. Did you enjoy the experience when it materialised?
It's true. I mean, this film has come over critically lauded across the board, it seems. You know, a career, a comeback for Michael Keaton. One of the best trailers I saw all of last year, I would say. I know how you and Mark feel about it, so I'm going to try and be positive. There is plenty to enjoy here. There's plenty to admire here. It is not as amusing as I thought it would be from the trailer. Michael Keaton is electrifying, actually, and I think we were in the car on the way home. I went to go and sit with my husband. He really didn't even like it as much as I did, and he said, "Well, Emma, who would you recommend this to?" And I kind of would begin and end really with Michael Keaton fans. If you are a Michael Keaton fan, you will get a lot out of this. You will, because it is a virtuoso performance. It's surrounded by other pretty good performances. Emma Stone stands out, I think. Edward Norton is entertaining. Zach Galifianakis gives some excellent work in a kind of pretty straight role. I think critics love it because it is a film. It's this weird mashup of kind of the classic backstage farce, like almost like Noises Off or whatever, this whole kind of chaotic backstage thing mashed up with a middle-aged guy having a nervous breakdown, effectively, mashed up with some rather obvious satire on Hollywood's view of superheroes and you know, the superhero franchise, the cartoon franchise. But I think it does deserve props for doing something different. I think it has some very arresting visual images in it. Whether or not you feel that just takes away from the film, it's just the only thing it's got is this kind of incredible tracking shot by the guy who did the gravity tracking shot or whatever, and it's all shot in that. But it does give you something to be in awe of where those cuts might come. It's brittle, it's a bit frenetic, it's... Like I say, you're not really emotionally engaged. It's a bit of an assault on the senses, but I think it's... Like I said, having listened to a fairly... You know, we're reviewing a set of fairly bland... Three of the three middle films that say Exodus, Unbroken and Big Eyes have not exactly come out of this show particularly well. So I think maybe do go and see Birdman. Make your own opinion about it. Because it's saying something. Not quite sure if I agree with it, but it's saying something.
Is it saying lies, Mark? Is it because it seems to be very based a little bit like David Cronenberg's Map of the Stars earlier this year, which I enjoyed much more than this, but it seems to be based on the sort of rather old version of Hollywood where theatre hates Hollywood, when we know Hollywood actors are on the stage all the time. It seems to be based on a sort of rather pompous and snobbish view of cinema.
And there's lots of cheap shots in the beginning. They're picking out sort of names of real actors, and there's that strange overlap between the real world and the fake world. And I think, you know, when you look at something like The Larry Sanders Show, which was on TV 20 years ago and was much more effective on a weekly basis at picking out these kind of breakdowns of, you know, the sort of satire against the real world, you know, you think we'd have kind of found different avenues to explore. That feels like a retrograde step. The thing for me about the film was it felt exhausting watching it because it's a long continuous take, because it's constantly almost in close-up on the characters. The first 40 minutes in particular are almost in constant either tracking motion of a character or they're in sort of two-shot close-up because there's never a cut. You're panning between close-up
faces. They've got quite wide lenses, so faces become slightly distorted, which is interesting.
To use one of my very fond analogies, it's like watching Olympic walking. You admire the technical achievement of doing it, but there's a constant aggressive tone towards it, and to watch 2 hours of it is a real achievement. And ultimately, there's that same dishonest feel about it, because you always feel it's trying to be clever. You know, things like Edward Norton's performance, he's renowned as a method actor who is someone who...
He changes things in the edit, in his first scene in this, starts to change the script.
Yes.
And I didn't quite know what the point was there.
Is it not Edward Norton playing a little bit on Edward Norton's reputation as being a fairly difficult and...
I don't understand what we gain by that. I'd rather he just behaved better.
I have no sympathy for a well-paid Hollywood actor sending himself up in a big-budget Hollywood picture. That doesn't, to me, suggest anything about an inside character.
I'm not asking you to have sympathy. I'm just saying think that's the point.
But again, that becomes a bit of the sneer, and I think that's the problem. If he's only known for being difficult on the set of films he hasn't taken seriously, or the more blockbuster entertainment. He doesn't play up on the set of Grand Budapest. He plays up on the set of The Incredible Hulk. And I felt the fact that it felt part of the sneer. I don't like superhero films very much, or I don't enjoy them, I don't dislike them. But this film felt just like it was sneering at all of those things, and
I didn't get the sneering. I didn't necessarily, like I say, I thought it was going to be maybe slightly deeper or funnier than it was, and it was neither of those things. But I didn't get the sneering thing. I mean, you could go on to a massive and long conversation about, you know, where Michael Keaton ends. It's obviously deliberate that they've cast the ex-Batman as Birdman, but this is a character unlike anything Michael Keaton has played, you know. But they do a very good job in harnessing that energy. We were only just mentioning Beetlejuice. Mm. And Michael Keaton has an energy on screen which will rival any actor, I think. And I think they do a brilliant job with that. And it's a very unselfish, and it's a very unvain performance from Michael Keaton. I mean, you see every wrinkle, you see every paunch, and I take my hat off to that, and I can't dismiss this film too much purely for that reason.
There are moments of great energy, you know, when actually Birdman appears on screen with Keaton. You know, the film really does feel like it's letting rip. Actually, for me, the film is its most effective when it gets to some of the quieter character moments. Once you've got through that first 45 minutes, once the intensity is actually allowed to come off a little and you actually start to get quieter moments. Some of the scenes with Lindsay Duncan as the reviewer worked.
I didn't like Lindsay Duncan, but I did love Amy Ryan as his wife.
I would also say Andrea Riseborough, who is I would watch in absolutely anything. Yeah.
All this pretense, and for some, we've got another film like 8.5, like 9, like All That Jazz, with a troubled male protagonist with his female muses, his ex-wife. It's all just a rip-off of other stuff to me. It went an empty,
It is a bit Emperor's New Clothes. It's a technical achievement that's overlooking some of the artistic merit, and you know, I think some of that gets lost. There's some nice quieter character moments. It's not without merit. It's a lot better than most of the films we talked about this week in that sense, but it's one I would struggle to watch again in one sitting.
Okay, well, we've only got 30 seconds to wrap things up. We will be back in a fortnight's time on January the 17th. We'll be reviewing Foxcatcher and American Sniper, which seem vaguely similar in sort of themes, and the Stephen Sondheim adaptation Into the Woods. Don't forget, on the 13th of January, the Arts Picture House has a preview screening of Beyond Clueless, so I thought I'd play out with a little bit of music from that. Please stay tuned for Bookmark. But from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
sky.